Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, together with Cynthia McClure. Hello, Cynthia, and welcome to you, the listener.
Hello, Ursula, and hello to you, the listener. Today is Wednesday, so we will be getting a weekly Local Talk update from Vivica Dillard. Also, sports legend Harrison Barnes was in Ames last week, where he made a contribution to the Ames Historical Society. Vivica caught an interview with him, and we'll share that with you this morning.
A little piece of Ames history in the area of sports triumphs. Vivica is our sports reporter. And later in the show, Johnny Hammond will speak with us about Heartland Services, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary.
Next Tuesday, July 29th, several Iowa State University departments, along with Story County and the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, will host the second annual Homeless Veterans Stand-Down at Brookside Park in Ames. It's one of more than 200 stand-downs support initiatives held annually, which provide services such as meals, clothing, dental, and health screening, Veterans Affairs benefits, counseling, and many other services for those in need.
And last but not least, we will call somebody named Pete Tredish in Philadelphia. As you know, KHOI will be hosting the Grassroots Radio Conference, a national radio conference here in Ames in August. Many of the 150 or so conference goers who will be coming to Ames will be people who are building new low-power radio stations, which is a movement, which is a national movement, and they'll be building them around the country. This is part of a historic chapter in radio, and it started to a large extent because of a group in Philly called the Prometheus Radio Project, founded by Pete, who's going to be speaking with us today. So we wanted to speak with him to inform you of some of the meaning and mission behind the conference that we're planning here in Ames on August 14th through 17th. You, of course, are invited to join us when the conference happens.
But first, let's look at the weather.
The weather, I had trouble believing the weather report.
Yeah,
but it
is government.
True. This morning when I got up, I was cold. I was chilly coming here to the station. So it's predicted that it's going to be mostly sunny with a high near 80 today. And tonight it will remain clear with a low around 58 with almost no wind.
Nice.
There will be a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. tomorrow on Thursday. But the day is predicted to be mostly with a high near 78. Wow. On Thursday night, there will be a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low around 62. And again on Friday, there will be a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high near 83. And on Friday, there will be a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low around 67 degrees. So the weather is predicted to remain very mild, not so hot, and I may even get away with not having to water the garden this week.
Thanks, Ursula. Last week, former Ames basketball star Harrison Barnes returned to Ames 3 days ago, and while he was there, he donated his jersey to the Ames Historical Center.
And Barnes grew up in Ames, and he played for Ames High wearing jersey number 40. And together with teammate Doug McDermott, he led Ames High to an Iowa 4A championship during both his junior and senior years, becoming Iowa's big school class's first team to go undefeated in consecutive seasons. Barnes capped off his Ames High career as their all-time leading scorer with 1,787 points. Barnes has gone on to a distinguished career, including the likes of junior national select team, 2010 McDonald's All-American Game, Jordan Brand Classic, and in 2010, Barnes won the Morgan Wooten Player of the Year Award, which goes to the nation's top player. He currently plays for the Golden State Warriors based in Oakland, California.
As Ursula said, Harrison was back in Ames last week to donate his jersey to the Ames Historical Center. KHOI sports reporter Vivica Dillard caught up with him. Here is a recording of her report along with her weekly sports update.
This past week, I was able to catch up with Ames native, former North Carolina star, and current player for the Golden State Warriors, Harrison Barnes. For those who aren't aware, Harrison has been in and out of Ames this offseason, doing a number of volunteer work in the community while also visiting with his mom and two sisters. I was able to catch Harrison while he was at the Ames Historic Society signing and donating memorabilia from his career. So let's check that out. So coming back home, seeing all your stuff from 4 or 5 years ago and stuff. So what kind of memories does this bring back for you?
It's crazy. I mean, like I said, just to see this, you know, and realize, man, this was 4 years ago, and just be like, man, there's a lot has happened in 4 years. It's unbelievable, and I'm just so honored.
Yeah. I remember coming to see the first time I saw you in high school. I went to junior college. I went to Iowa Central. So I remember coming out here, and they were telling me, Harrison Barnes, he's the number one player in the country. I'm like, no way. Let me see this guy. And to come to Little Old, I had never heard of Ames, Iowa. Yeah. You know what I mean? So what kind of hearing stories like that and just seeing the impact that you had on places such as Little Old Ames, Iowa, you know what I mean? What does that do to you? Like,
I mean, it's definitely humbling. I mean, just to, you know, just to look it back and just to see the magnitude of it. Because at the time, I mean, you're playing, you're like, you know, yeah, we're getting good crowds, you know, but you don't understand, like, the magnitude of it. You don't understand, like, you know, 4 years removed, you know, you see, you know, little kids are like, you know, I grew up, you know, watching, you know, you guys play. And, you know, I'm talking to my high school teammates. Like, dude, we were talking about watching, you know, other guys play. You know what I'm saying? We were talking about, you know, those guys, and we wanted to be them. And now the young group saying that they wanted to be us, you know, it's kind of weird to see. But, you know, it was just... You know, you really just appreciate, you know, all the times that you had, and just to see the kind of like that lasting impact, not only on little kids, but just our community. Yeah. You know, it was a big deal.
Yep. So how's the off season been for you?
Off season's been good. I've just been working out, trying to get in shape, going to USA basketball at the end of the month here. So definitely excited about that. That should be fun.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, best of luck with you on that one. So thank you again for coming out to Ames and signing autographs, taking pictures. So I'm sure it's a lot of kids that will remember this day.
So. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yep. And something I didn't get the chance to ask him while interviewing him was how he felt about, you know, coming back for a preseason game in October against the Denver Nuggets. And he was pretty excited about that. He says it's a great opportunity to get people of Ames out to see him who aren't really able to fly out to get to some of the other games. So he's really excited, and he thinks it'll be, you know, a really good crowd. And while we're on the topic of NBA, the Los Angeles Clippers are still stuck between a rock and a hard place as owner. Donald Sterling is still fighting to remain owner after some disgusting racist remarks of his got released this past season. Clippers coach Doc Rivers has said that he will exit if he is not forced out of ownership of the team. This also puts players like Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, and DeAndre Jordan, just to name a few, who are leaders of the team but also are not free agents, so they don't really have that freedom to just leave the team in the event that he remains owner. So that is something that everyone is waiting to see the end results on. Now, let's talk women's basketball. This isn't really something that very many people talk about, but as you may know, women's basketball in general is just growing and becoming more and more popular in this country. This past weekend was the All-Star Game, and rookie Shona Schimmel of the Atlanta Dream put up a record-breaking performance with 29 points. Now, a lot of people found that very interesting considering she doesn't even star for her own team. So it was great that her and second-year players Brittany Griner and Skylar Diggins were able to put up a good performance in Phoenix this past weekend for fans. That 29 points also helped the East All-Stars beat the West All-Stars in the first WNBA All-Star game overtime. So congratulations with that, and, you know, they were able to make some history. Now, moving on to the NFL. The first openly gay football player, Michael Sam, is once again the face of controversy. Former NFL coach Tony Dungy was quoted saying he would not have drafted him. With this statement being out there, people are wondering, is this a statement based on his talent or because of his sexuality? And for some of those who aren't aware, Dungy has previously been quoted saying he supports the ban on gay marriage. So this is just stirring up a lot of controversy in the sports world. So keep your ears open, and I'll keep everyone updated on that. Well, that wraps up another week in sports. I'll hand it back to you, ladies.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. You were just listening to a sports update from Vivica Dillard, who's our new sports reporter, and we're thrilled to have her on the team. Heartland Senior Services is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year, and to celebrate this, there'll be a picnic and a barbecue to be held at Heartland, which is 205 South Walnut on Friday, August 22nd, so it's coming up next month. And you're going to be invited to the picnic and also to get a tour of the facilities at Heartland. So some of the folks from Heartland came by to tell us about this in advance. One of Heartland's founders was Johnny Hammond, and Johnny's birthday also just will be falling on that day as well. which may or may not be a coincidence. So Johnny came by KHOI, and she came with Jan Williams, who's Heartland's Director of Development and Marketing, and they talked about the early years and growth of Heartland. KHOI reporter Kay Patak interviewed them when they came in. So let's listen to that interview.
Two very distinguished guests today, Jan Williams, the Director of Development and Marketing at Heartland Senior Services, and Johnny Hammond, the former, well, I'll give you a sort of brief synopsis of her career, starting out on the Story County Board of Supervisors, then a state representative, and then a state senator. And in addition to that, she's done all sorts of work for low-income children and women, for affordable housing, for rehabilitation for women offenders, and something I didn't know before, for seniors. And that's what she's come to talk about today, because she was one of the founders of Heartland Senior Services. So welcome to both of you. Welcome, Johnny, and welcome, Jan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kay, I'd like to first thank you for giving us the time to share a little bit of information about the history of Heartland Senior Services. We have been around for four decades. We are celebrating our 40th year of operation, of providing programs and services to older adults and their families throughout Story County. And with that, we thought it would be most appropriate for Johnny to share her vision and her insight into what exactly she saw back then and as the evolution and progression of our agency has developed. We thought it would be most beneficial for our listeners to hear from Johnny herself about how we've come to be.
Yes, and this is very appropriate for this year in many ways, because it's a sesquicentennial year, and it's an anniversary for you, a 40-year anniversary. So it'd be lovely to hear some of the history.
And it's great to know that you have thrived over 40 years. First thing I would want to say is that I take a backstage to a couple of people who have left this earth, but who did much more and were much more the dreamers than I was. And that's Gracie Larson and Ann Charles. Ann started the adult daycare program, and she did this at a time when I was actually campaigning to be county supervisor back in 1974. And at that time, we were also looking at developing a comprehensive umbrella program for senior citizens. And so the Story County Council on Aging bylaws were being worked on back there in 74. But Ann, then immediately after I was elected to the Board of Supervisors, was coming to get some financial support for the adult daycare program. She was a delightful person to work with, and I actually was employed then. After my 4 years on the Board of Supervisors, I was looking for work. In around 1979, 1980, I was employed by the adult daycare program. And it was Ann who had the dream that we needed to have a new building where everybody could meet together for congregate meals, for getting their hair done, for adult daycare, for all the things that are now available at Heartland.
Do hairdressing at Heartland? I didn't know that.
We used to do hair, yes. We used to have a beauty shop there that was actually open to the public.
Okay.
I mean, that beauty shop, that sink is gone now? Well, it has grown in many ways and changed in many ways. And I know Jan can tell that more than I can, all the services that are being provided there. I struggled with transportation problems, and that has, from the beginning, has always been a challenge to do that well.
Could you clarify a bit there? What does Heartland have to do with transportation? How do they?
Yeah, we used to be the conduit. We used to have a dispatch office and a scheduling office where it was a partnership that we had with the HERTA, or the Heart of Iowa Regional Transit. And then just in the last, again, because of some changes over the past year and a half, HERTA has taken the onus of that completely. So we still have many older adults that utilize HERTA to come and go into our facility.
But it was, you were sort of like the pioneers for, you might say, for getting HERTA, what is now HERTA.
Well,
started.
I wouldn't say for HERTA, but at least to get transportation programs going for people who had no other way.
Right.
I was actually hiring the bus drivers at that time.
And so things have changed a lot since the early days, and you've developed into all sorts of wonderful services. Perhaps Jan would like to talk a bit about those.
We talk about the evolution of our programs and services over 40 years, because if some of our listeners recall, our meals, our congregate and home-delivered meals back in the day, they actually started out of the basement of Collegiate United Methodist Church. And so even that nutrition program has since moved in location, but clearly the number of meals that we serve throughout Story County has certainly grown. Mm-hmm. In addition, back in the day, our services of the Adult Day Center used to be in the basement of the Riverside Nursing Home facility.
Wow.
That's where that started. And then because of the vision of Johnny and Ann and Gracie, we had the foresight to move that, build it, actually, at the current 205 South Walnut address. So we tried to be as accessible to people as possible. And with our programs as they are today, it's only because of the vision of these ladies that we are offering the services that we are to all of Story County. So I wanted to be clear and have people understand that we're not just providing services to Ames residents. We provide services throughout all of Story County.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which was one of the reasons for having that transportation system.
Right,
they needed transportation in Maxwell, too.
Right.
And they had a strong program there, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So talking about the home-delivered meals, for example, they are delivered all over Story County also.
That's correct.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And do you coordinate all that from the central office?
Right. And so really, I should talk about, you know, we've got a cadre of volunteer support, of board members who have changed over the years. We really couldn't operate and have that type of sustainability and support without those volunteers to deliver meals throughout Story County, to help with our activities, to help be activity assistants, to help serve meals in the Adult Day Center. I mean, we have a very lean staff where we
right.
are. And so I think with the foresight of years of progression of how we go about doing business, we have to incorporate that volunteer piece to it. It's so critical. So that nutrition piece, for example, delivering meals, we are the nucleus, if you will, of providing and preparing those meals, and then they go out to our different...
Now, you got a new oven recently.
We did get a new oven.
A special oven.
We did get a combi oven, a convection oven.
Story County Foundation.
Yes, thanks to the support and the partnership of the Story County Community Foundation, we were able to remodel our kitchen a little bit to be more efficient, because we had seen over the years that the delivery of those meals continue to be on the rise, and that still is the case with our home-delivered meals. And so we needed to be creative, judicious with the remodeling efforts, because that building is aging. I mean,
yes.
There's no secret to that. And so we purchased a couple new refrigerators. We purchased a new oven. We're using that facility as best we can mm-hmm. over the 40 years to still be as efficient as we can in delivery of services.
Right. Now, this oven, it's a very special oven, and it has improved your efficiency a lot. But, as you mentioned, you still need more drivers to deliver more meals.
Oh, that's absolutely
so
true.
So do you want to put in a plug here about volunteers?
So thank you, Kate. So our volunteers are so critical to our service operation, particularly in the nutrition program. Because we prepare the meals at the 205 South Walnut address, our nutrition director then coordinates the volunteer efforts for those meals to be delivered throughout Story County. We call them participants. There are participants in these rural communities that are relying on our meal for their sustainability. So I think that's critical in that people understand the fact that our services do have a social component to it. They do have a nutritious component to it. The services that we provide there are so critical, not only for the participant themselves, but for the caregiver. And
right.
that becomes
right.
very essential, because we know people are working longer. We know that families relocate to be closer to kids, grandkids, etc. but it's then what you do with your time while you're here. And many people, if your son or daughter still has to go to work, what are you going to do with your mother or daughter? You're not going to leave them alone, or you don't want to leave them in isolation. You want to maybe factor in that socialization piece. You want to make sure they get a meal.
And that someone visits during the day.
That is correct.
I believe they often, the person that delivers the meal often stays and chats for a while.
And I mean, that may be the only other contact a person has in the day.
That's a very good point. And so when our volunteers are delivering those meals, you know what? If they don't come to the door, we know there's an issue there because they have an expectation that that meal is going to be delivered. So not only is that one-on-one FaceTime very important, but we can also recognize a challenge or a problem that might arise that day.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if people want to volunteer to be drivers to deliver meals, who should they contact?
Oh, my goodness. They could call us at 233-2906. They want to ask for our nutrition director, and they want to say that they can give an hour and a half of time. They would start at our office at 205 South Walnut, or they may start at one of our drop-off points, for example, in the county. And so those volunteer drivers are so critical, and we want people to know that we really rely on your efforts. If you can spare an hour and a half, it doesn't even have to be every day. We could have it set up for maybe a Tuesday, Thursday, or a Monday, Wednesday, Friday delivery run, or maybe it is just one time a week. But if you have some time in your schedule and you can devote to delivering meals to older adults throughout the county, give us a call, ask for our nutrition department, and we will get you scheduled.
And, of course, you can find these numbers on their website, and we'll put it up on our website after the program.
And you know, I want to say something about that. It's a bonus not just for the person receiving the meal, but the person delivering the meal gets a lot out of it, too.
Yes,
it's
sure.
Fun to get acquainted with those folks as you deliver the meals to them. I haven't done a lot of that, but I've done a little.
Uh-huh. And the number again is 233-2906.
Or our listeners can go to our website at heartlandseniorservices.com. We list all of our programs on there. We have menus on there. We try and be as current as possible with our upcoming events and our socialization opportunities. Any of our program directors are available to provide information. We also encourage people to come in for a tour. I'm more of a visual person, and so for people to come in and actually see what happens during the day on any given day, we could have an activity going on down there.
Now, you mentioned coming in for a meal. Those would be the congregate meals.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Correct. Anyone is welcome to come in for lunch. We ask for a suggested contribution if you're over the age of 60. We encourage people to stop in. We try and be as welcoming as possible. And I want to give a shout out and kudos to Johnny for all of her work and dedication and actually vision. Because, you know, like we say, we were celebrating our 40th year. We want to be around in another 40 years. Mm-hmm. And we also anticipate there's going to be continued evolution in the next four decades.
Right.
Because change is inevitable. And as Johnny can attest to, we have changed over 40 years from when the initial vision was there. And so we just want to thrive and be an essential partner in this community as possible.
And before we end, I do want to emphasize that Heartland, of course, offers many other services in addition to the nutrition programs. You have the activities every day, aerobics.
Correct.
And adult daycare, and a lot going on.
That is true.
And we're absolutely very grateful to people like Johnny who had the vision to start something like this and put in so much work to it, and we're reaping the benefits of it today. And also before we end, we've got a very important picnic coming up, I believe.
We have actually been contemplating how to acknowledge being around for 40 years. And so a 40th anniversary picnic celebration is going to take place on Friday, August 22nd of this summer. And honestly, I can't imagine a better day now that I've heard that it's Johnny's birthday that day. And
wonderful.
The gods were talking to us, and we picked that date, and Johnny tells me, hey, by the way, that's my birthday. So we really planned that out right. But our picnic is going to be Friday, August 22nd from 11:30 to 1:30. It is open to the public because we have so many friends and partners. We couldn't begin to thank or rule them out. And so we're opening up as a public celebration of Heartland. The picnic is at the building. We're going to have both inside and outside seating available. So it's going to be a barbecue flair. We're going to have some games outside, going to have a few giveaways. So we want people to put that on their calendars. Friday, August 22nd, it'll be a come-and-go lunch. So we will serve from 11:30 to 1:30. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it is a celebration not only of older adults and their caregivers and their family members, but it's a celebration about being in Ames and Storey County for 40 years.
Congratulations again. We'll look forward to the picnic.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Johnny Hammond and Jan Williams.
Thank you.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio.
Like Kay said, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and if you've just tuned in, you've been listening to an interview with Johnny Hammond and Jane Williams about the 40th anniversary of a much-loved institution in our community, Heartland Senior Services. We're pleased to also talk about the Homeless Veteran Stand-Down at Brookside Park in Ames.
This is an event that we want to let you know about. It's happening on Tuesday, July 29th, as a way for all of us to recognize the needs of veterans as well as anybody who's homeless in our areas. Several Iowa State University departments, along with the Storey County County and U.S. Departments of Veteran Affairs will host it, and the goal is to provide services such as meals, clothing, dental and health screenings, VA benefit counseling, and a whole lot of other services to those who are in need.
An annual event held all over the country. This is the second year it is here in Ames. This will be this Tuesday, and it's a homeless veteran stand down. Again, this will be July 29th at 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Brookside Park here in Ames at the Maple Lodge.
And the organizers of this event have emphasized that this event is not only for veterans, mm-hmm. but for anybody who's homeless or almost homeless that could use services. And children are welcome, and all you have to do is show up.
It's a very friendly crowd. We had them in last year, and they were very nice and gracious, and they have a lot of services available, including mental health screening and how to get a job, need to be fed, need new clothes. That's the place for you.
We're going to try to get one of the organizers in here before the event happens next Tuesday.
Excellent.
You are listening to Local Talk. In the last part of our show, we are going to talk about radio. That is the low-power radio movement. KHOI is going to be hosting a national radio conference this August. It's a conference which happens every year at a different location around the country. And this year, it's going to be here at KHOI. We're very excited to have this conference here. We're going to be hosting it in downtown Ames. The Octagon is going to be our conference center. A very historic aspect of the conference is that a whole new generation of radio builders have arrived in the scene in the last few years. The low-power radio stations that have just all gotten their permits from the Federal Communications Commission to build radio stations. These guys are all over the country. One of the specific focuses of the conference in August will be helping these newcomers to radio build their stations. We're going to speak today with a very distinguished radio personality. His name is Pete Tredish. He will be speaking to us, I think, from Philadelphia. He's played an important role in the community radio history as a founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, which is largely responsible for the low-power movement. So we're going to play a little piece of music so Rick has time to call Pete, and then we're going to speak with Pete about what the low-power movement signifies and how this happened. Thank you. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with Cynthia McClure. And in this last part of the show, we are talking about radio, talking about low-power radio. And we have with us Pete Treadish, who is with us, I think, from Philadelphia. Are you there, Pete?
Yeah.
Hi, Pete.
Great to be on the show.
Good to have you. Are you in Philadelphia?
I am in Philadelphia right now.
Thank you so much for joining us. One of the reasons we're talking with Pete right now is because in August, in just 3 weeks, we will be holding a national radio conference here in Iowa. And it's a historic conference because there are so many low-power stations being built right now because of a recent filing window with the Federal Communications Bureau, which has given people all over the country permits to build low-power radio stations. Pete has been probably the pivotal character in the story of the low-power movement. So, Pete, could you explain a little bit what is an LPFM?
Sure thing. For many, many years, it was pretty much impossible to get a radio license from about the early 80s until around the year 2000. Almost no radio licenses were given out because the commercial radio broadcasters, and to some extent some of the public broadcasters as well, managed to get a lock on the process and actually shut it down because they did not want any more competition on the airwave. And so the Clear Channels of the world and the Cumuluses and some of these big companies persuaded the FCC to just stop giving out radio licenses during that time. And what emerged in the late 90s was a movement of radio pirates, people who decided to just go on the air without licenses and risk tens of thousands of dollars of fines and possible jail time in order to start community radio stations. And over the years, this got to be bigger and bigger, and there were some court cases that ended up throwing into question the whole way that radio was regulated in the United States. And under the pressure from that, the FCC changed its rules in 2000. They started giving out 100-watt community radio licenses. And that was a first wave of low-power radio that happened around 2000, 2001, 2002.
Can you just explain why the 100-watt?
Yeah.
Most listeners may not understand the significance of such a low wattage station and finding space on the dial.
And Pete, just for our listeners, because I don't know how far 100 watts would the range of that is, can you describe, how many city blocks or how big of an area 100 watts can reach?
100 watts can usually go somewhere between 4 and 10 miles, depending on how many other stations are on the dial. One thing I like to compare it to, actually, is government. I mean, we have a federal government, and then we have state governments, and then we have local governments, and then we have school boards. And so what made sense to us is not everybody wants to have a radio station that reaches millions and millions of people. There's a use to every different level for different things. If I went on a giant station in New York, my listeners would not be interested in hearing the results of the school board election in, one tiny corner of one tiny neighborhood.
What you're saying is that these low wattage stations are basically a very intimate source for communities to communicate with each other. They're building their own communities through communication.
Right, exactly. So it's all about having the right scale for the right kind of programming and content. And so what was really lacking in the radio of the 80s and the 90s was this kind of, very close local content. Today as well, radio had turned into a thing that had to be very, very big. And what low-power radio stations do is it makes it so that a high school could have a radio station or a farm workers union or any of a number of, sort of smaller entities could operate something that is of local and immediate interest.
Pete, what went into making this a legal entity in the United States? You literally are talking about what was a new form of radio in terms of the legal definitions that the Federal Communications Commission had. Can you describe a little bit what went behind that?
There was an illegal radio movement that put pressure on the FCC for about 7 to 7 or 8 years before the FCC changed its mind and started issuing licenses for 100-watt radio stations. That was the result of court cases, of rulemakings, of a whole set of engineering studies. And so finally in 2000, the FCC changed its mind, but that wasn't enough because they were going to start issuing radio licenses all across the country. But then the really large incumbent broadcasters, Clear Channels and all those kinds of groups, they got a law passed through Congress that limited the FCC's ability to give 100-watt radio licenses, these local licenses, out in major cities. So starting in 2000, 2001, 2002, we were able to build radio stations in Opelousas, Louisiana, but not in New Orleans. We were able to put radio stations in Davis, California, but not in San Francisco or Los Angeles. And so that started a 10-year struggle to pass a law through Congress that would allow the Power FM also to be available to over 60% of the American population in these large urban areas. And we passed that law in 2011. And just in late 2013, we finally had the opportunity to apply. And there are going to be new community radio stations in pretty much every city in the United States, at least three or four in every place. And in smaller towns, there are a lot more opportunities.
Really, this is a movement that had, in a sense, two waves, right? There was a first wave where the more rural areas were able to get licenses or permits, and now there's a second wave happening. Is that a good way to think about it?
Yeah, exactly. The first wave was very successful, but lots of people never heard of low power radio because it was, you know, some of them were in reasonable-sized towns, but a lot of the places were in places where there were a lot more cows than people. And that is exactly how the commercial broadcasters wanted it. They were like, okay, you can have your low-power radio stations, but you can't have them where you're going to actually add competition to the market. I'm competing for ad dollars. But we took the accomplishments of the first round of low-power FM, and we were able to turn that into enough of a political movement to beat a $27 million a year lobbying organization, the National Association of Broadcasters, and force it so that Low Power FM could actually be everywhere in the country. So there were about 2,700 applications for new low power radio stations in 2013, and a number of them were starting to get built. In fact, on my way to the conference, I'm going to be stopping and working on two new stations in Madison, Wisconsin. And after, I'm going to drive my little car across the country and work on several more, potentially one with a tribe out in Arizona and perhaps some others if we can line it all up.
I think it needs to be said that Pete is maintaining a very humble stance right now in this interview. In fact, Pete is really a historic figure in the history of radio, and we're really listening to somebody who's talking about driving in his car across country and helping people get radio stations off the ground. But he's also a person who has spent a great deal of time in Washington, D.C., walking the halls of our Capitol building to really change the attitude not only of our congressmen, but also the FCC commissioners themselves. And as you described, this is a movement that started out with what was essentially pirate stations.
Pete, you were a pirate. You were one of these pirated stations for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, the way that we started, I was a carpenter and an activist in late 90s, actually around 96 or so, and we had heard that there was a pirate radio station in Berkeley where they had been busted by the police and by the FCC, and they were dragged to court, and they got a really great lawyer from the National Lawyers Guild, and the whole FCC regulation scheme was suddenly sort of thrown into question because the FCC has the right to give out radio licenses and say who can be on the air and who cannot be on the air. And that there's not a First Amendment right to broadcast. But the way the law is written, the FCC is supposed to use the lightest possible hand and be sort of the most open and democratic in the distribution of licenses that it can manage. And the lawyer basically said, okay, Clear Channel has 1,200 radio stations, and my client can't get any radio station. You know, that's why he's a pirate. And the judge in that case was like, wow, really? Is that how bad our licensing scheme is stacked? I have to think about this. And so she actually did not send this broadcaster to jail and actually just said, yeah, he can keep going until I make my decision. And it took her 4 years to make the decision. Ultimately, she did rule against the pirate broadcaster. But in that space of 4 years, between 94 and 98, it was not really clear that the FCC could stop anyone from broadcasting a pirate radio station. So myself and some other activist friends here in Philadelphia decided to jump on the bandwagon, and we started a pirate radio station, and we were among about 1,000 radio pirates across the country that did a similar thing. And so we kind of changed the reality on the ground, and then the law had to adapt to the new reality that there were these thousands of people that were, you know, doing what people at your station do. They, you know, they go to the station, they make a show, they, you know, broadcast to their community, they get really involved and connected to everything that's going on. And so eventually that reality on the ground helped to push the FCC to see how it would be different if there was a locally based radio service. That's essentially how low power radio came to be. It was a civil disobedience movement that eventually became so big that it couldn't really be shut down, and it had to, the law had to accommodate itself to what people were doing instead of people accommodating themselves to what the law said they had to do.
Now, when we talk about the FCC, can you describe a little bit what in reality is the FCC?
Well, I think they have about 3,000 employees, most of them in Washington, D.C., but they also have field offices where they have the, you know, people in the vans that go around chasing people that are pirate radio operators or whatever. It's appointed by the president, and there are 5 commissioners, 3 from whoever the party of the president is, and 2 from the only other sanctioned opposing party, so... You know, right now it's 3 Democrats and 2 Republicans. And then there's a large civil service bureaucracy that they preside over. And they do a lot of things like they give out radio permits. They decide things like net neutrality or make decisions about anything having to do with mobile phones, certain aspects of the Internet, anything that has to do with licensing and permitting.
When you were working with them to get low power, where it was really Congress that had to make low power radio legal, right?
Well, it's a funny thing, because normally the FCC would just make the decision up by itself, because it is in the purview of their decision making at the FCC.
Mm-hmm.
However, in this case, the FCC made a decision in our favor instead of in favor of the corporations, and that was so outrageous and outlandish that you know, they went up the, you know, like, can I speak to your manager? The broadcasters went to Congress and said, the FCC has made a terrible, terrible mistake by listening to regular people. You have to take away their authority in this particular thing. So Congress didn't take away the FCC's authority over full power radio stations or anything else that it did. They just said, you can't put 100-watt radio stations in cities. It was a very contorted piece of legislation that was passed in 2000 to limit the FCC's authority and make it so that they wouldn't be able to essentially give licenses to people in Los Angeles or San Francisco.
So they basically, through a congressional mandate, they eliminated the competition. They lobbied and won.
Yeah. Sometimes I like to say that we won and we got the right to create these low-power radio stations, but really in a lot of ways the NAB won. They managed to stop us for 10 years from nonsense. And so there could have been all these radio stations starting in 2000, but they managed to delay for
10
basically
years,
10 years plus 2 or 3 years that it took the FCC to implement the new legislation as regulations. And so... yeah, a lot of stations that should have been on the air in 2001, 2002 are just building now.
Right. And that's what we're going to be working on here in Ames in August. To give credit where credit's due, who sponsored the bill in Congress that made this possible for these stations to go on the air?
It was sponsored by Representative Mike Doyle from Pittsburgh, the Democrat side in Congress, and Lee Terry of Nebraska on the Republican side. And in the Senate, it was Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, I'm a Democrat, and John McCain. John McCain was a convert to the PowerFM.
Nice.
So, Pete, you are coming to Ames soon, so we look forward to having you.
I'm excited to be coming to Ames.
We are so pleased to have you.
I was one of the only states I haven't been to. I think I'll be up to 45 states now.
Yeah. And this will be August 14th through the 17th.
Time.
We've been speaking with Pete Tredish, who is one of the founders or the founder of the Prometheus Radio Project in Philadelphia, which was largely responsible for getting the low power frequencies on the air. And Pete is still building radio stations, and he's coming through Iowa
on his road trip across America to
build radio,
community radio.
So it's going to be really great to have you. I guess we should close out the show, Cynthia. Thank you for joining us, Pete. See you soon.
And during
Can't wait to come to Ames.
Okay. Excellent. We're excited to meet you, sir. And during this conference, KHOI here in Ames is celebrating its second year on the air.
Absolutely.
It's going to be our birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The conference is going to be August 14th through 17th. And, of course, you're invited to join the conference as well. Mm-hmm. We're going to be making $20 day pass for anybody
for
that
locals.
Wants to come in and just browse the workshops and meet some of these really spectacular people that are coming in. Some of these are really historic figures like Pete. The conference is going to be at the Octagon. We are also looking for ways that you can participate in helping to make the conference.
Yes.
So we're looking for bicycles, if you can lend us a bicycle for a few days to help the conference goers. And we're also asking if you could host a conference goer by giving them a place to sleep, because some of these guys need places to sleep. Contact us at 292-2878, 292-2878, or just come by the Pantorium and talk to us. And the website for the conference is grc2014.net. That's grc2014.net.
And if you would like to volunteer, contact us, because volunteering throughout the whole conference would be a great way to get to know your local community radio station.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM Story City, Ames, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I would like to thank Vivica Dillard for her sports update and interview with Harrison Barnes, Kay Puttick, and her interview with Johnny Hammond and Jane Williams from Heartland Senior Services. For more information on the Homeless Veterans Stand Down, you can contact your local county VA coordinator. Just check it. Find that information on the web about local veteran services and the Homeless Stand Down, which is going to be here Tuesday, July 29th. And that will be, again, Tuesday, July 29th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Brookside Park in the Maple Lodge.
And we'd also like to thank our guest, Pete Tredish, founder of Prometheus Radio Project and Low Power Radio in the United States. And we thank all of our reporters and guests for making this a show that fulfills our mission at KHOI, which is to create community through communication.
We are looking for volunteers to participate in the Grassroots Radio Conference. So if you would like to join us, please contact us here at KHOI Community Radio.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. And you can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org.
Your participation as an audience and your generous donations help make KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Sleep.